Lessons learned in establishing a program for teaching peroral endoscopic myotomy, or POEM, presented by Luke Funk, Assistant Professor of Surgery and Director of Minimally Invasive Surgery Research, University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health, Madison. Dr. Funk spoke at the 9th Annual Current Topics in General Surgery, presented by the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Funk?
I wanted to address the following questions. If you're thinking about starting a new type of procedure or using a new device, do you need to think about IRB approval? Are you doing research just by using a new device? Who should be able to perform the procedure? And how do you create and train a team? And then I'm just going to use POEM as an example, kind of weave through the presentation. So in our field, there's a lot of new devices that have entered the arena over the past few years. Radio frequency energy application to the lower esophageal sphincter for reflux, that's known as Streta. The lower left is a schematic of an intragastric balloon, of which there are, I think, three now for a weight loss. There's the Aspire Assist device, which is a weight loss procedure that's FDA approved, which is essentially a PEG type of procedure, and you hook up a container to this device and drain contents from your stomach. There is augmentation of the lower esophageal sphincter for reflux, also known as LINX. There is transoral incisionless fundoplication, also known as TIF, or the Esophyx device, of which we have a number of providers in our state that are performing this, and we actually did a couple at our institution over the past few years. And then there's the robot. And so when you're thinking about utilizing these devices, what sorts of approvals do you need to think about, and how do you go about doing that? And then there's, I think, a different category where there isn't necessarily a new device or a new instrument, but it's a new application of existing instruments. So the picture on the left there is a laparoscopic greater curve plication. Basically, what you do is invaginate the greater curvature of the stomach, and you have essentially what's thought to be something similar to a sleeve gastrectomy. And then you have peroral endoscopic myotomy, which really there aren't any significant new instruments or devices that you need. It's all existing. But given that it's a new type of procedure, what sorts of approvals do you need to think about? So one thing that I think is always at least unclear to me is whether or not you need some sort of approval from an IRB. Is this research? Are you doing research just by using a new procedure or an experimental device? And so there's actually a website that we have at UW that we can go to, and you're trying to figure out, is this research or is this quality improvement? Or is this something else? And so there's a few questions that you can ask yourself. Is using this new technology or device something that's going to involve testing an experimental device? And it really boils down to, you know, what is experimental? You know, Webster says it's an untested idea or technique, but, you know, in practice, is something that's, you know, where there's a randomized trial, is that untested? What about if there's a bunch of case series that are published? Is that untested? And I think depending on what your perspective is, whether you're an insurance provider or you are an IRB officer, there is a gray area in terms of whether or not what you're doing is experimental. Even if it's an FDA-approved device, this can occasionally be interpreted by IRBs and certainly payers as experimental. Number two, is there a project associated with the device or the procedure that's received any type of research funding? So if it's an NIH-approved study, even if it's industry funding, and this funding is to do a human subjects research study, probably do need IRB approval. Is it a multi-site project? So maybe it's augmentation of the lower esophageal sphincter, of which there was a recently published multi-institutional prospective trial looking at the effects of this FDA-approved device. Is there a study-wide protocol? Yes, there would be in that case. So you would need IRB approval for that. And then this other important question that you want to ask yourself, does it involve systematic investigation designed with the intent to contribute to generalizable knowledge? So are you testing a specific hypothesis when you incorporate this device? Are you going to randomize patients? Are you going to do a case control type of study? Or do you have any specific plans to do observational research? And I underline that because I think that's another gray area where even if you do plan to follow your patients in a formal way, let's say you're collecting data on all patients in a database, and you're planning on, you know, looking at that data internally and trying to decide, you know, is this a procedure that I want to continue to offer? That isn't necessarily something that needs IRB approval. And so you want to, I think, obviously evaluate that question on a case-by-case basis. And just because you want to publish the results, it doesn't necessarily mean you need IRB approval. You can certainly publish data, and we've dealt with this in our own research group recently, where it's primarily quality improvement, and you can still publish it. So in general, though, I would say if your answer to any of those questions is yes, it's experimental, you receive some sort of funding, it's a multi-site, maybe prospective trial that you're involved with, or you have a specific study design for incorporating this particular instrument, then you probably need an IRB approval. However, if you're just planning on incorporating a device into your practice to take care of your patients, that's a different question. So those devices that I showed previously, Streta, Lynx, Arbera, which is intragastric balloon, Sofix, which is the transoral incisionless fundal application, the robot, you just want to use that, incorporate that into your practice to start taking care of your patients. You don't necessarily need IRB approval for that if you're not, you know, doing formal research. Like I said, just because you want to publish the results, it's not necessarily something you need review for. However, if you're going to do, like I said, if you want to do gastric placation, which I did in fellowship, I did a couple of these procedures as part of a multi-site trial. That is something that you want to get approval for. And the reason for that, why that's such an important issue, is if you're actually doing research on patients without an IRB approval, that's not something that you necessarily want to do. Here's another scenario. So you're a new faculty member who is trained to perform POEM during your MIS fellowship. Your institution wants to develop a POEM program. And there's a number of studies which are shown here in this white paper. The details of those aren't important, but suffice to say, there was reasonable evidence at the time from what was published, these case series, that it's feasible, it's safe, and it's effective. So would you get an IRB approval for this if you're that new faculty member? And that's what I was trying to think through when I started at UW in 2013. Complicated the scenario a little bit is where I came from to train, they actually did have an IRB approval for POEM, which they established in 2011. However, it was part of a specially designed trial with inclusion-exclusion criteria, specifically with one-year follow-up data. So that's why they went to their IRB there. We ultimately did not seek IRB approval. We worked with our division chief at the time, Dr. Herb Chen, to try to sort through this. He didn't think we needed it. We didn't think that the procedure was experimental at the time, given all the published data on it, and that there were thousands done all over the world. It wasn't part of a trial, and we were interested in incorporating it as a first-line treatment option for achalasia. So next you get to this question of who can and should be able to perform the procedure. You know, this can be an issue of turf battles. So just a couple of thoughts about that. Tip O'Neill said all politics is local, and obviously all of you throughout the state and the region know that. I don't need to tell anybody that. In this particular case, our players were our folks, MIS, GI, obviously, as the practitioners that are most commonly doing endoscopic procedures, you know, we wanted to involve them as well. And then thoracic surgery, they do a lot of benign foregut throughout the country and at our institution as well. And the advice that we got was to be inclusive. And I think that that was the right advice. And so we certainly invited GI to participate in one of our first POEMs. In fact, I remember one of our GI colleagues coming into the OR. We had just started our myotomy and we were looking up anteriorly and we could see the pericardium and the heart beating. And he asked us, what's that? And we told him, and he didn't swing back by the OR again after that. But he's still very involved in our multidisciplinary meetings, and he's a very valued partner. And I think he appreciated the invitation. We always told him he's more than welcome to scrub with us if he'd like. And the same thing with thoracic surgery. They aren't involved in these procedures at UW, but they certainly, you know, have always been welcome to participate with us. I think the other thing that was helpful was to establish hospital credentials. This is an email that I exchanged with one of the credentialing staff at UW a couple of years ago, where we were going through what we wanted to establish for our criteria. Basically, what we said is you had to have some sort of documented experience in the procedure, either in residency or fellowship. And if you didn't, you had to have at least one proctored case to substitute for that. And you needed to have demonstrated training in advanced endoscopy during your residency or fellowship. And then we have an ongoing requirement that you have to have 5 procedures performed over a 2-year period. And so for our particular program, I had participated in some during my fellowship. We began discussions with our GI colleagues in 2014. I brought Jake back to OSU, where I trained to observe a couple POEMs. We had a pig lab in the spring, and we established our credentials in the spring of that year as well. And then Dr. Shada joined us as well, so the 3 of us are involved in this. I think communication with industry is obviously critical in all these areas. The devices are made by industry, but I think ongoing communication with them as you're setting this up is critical. They work with providers all over the region that are doing these things and encountering these challenges. And then we handpicked our OR staff, and I see one sitting right there, Matt. We knew who kind of we wanted to work with because we felt like we had someone identified or a team identified that might be willing to try a new procedure and willing to join us in the animal lab and willing to do some dry runs with us. And I think that was really helpful. And obviously, he still continues to be very involved in that particular program, primarily at TAC at our East Side Hospital. But I think that was very helpful to have him involved. He could then, you know, go out and train the remaining staff. And then we did our first palm in April. I don't know what we wanted to do during that first case that was 300 minutes. It was miserable. But since then, you know, they average about 1 to 2 hours. And you can see there's some up and down based on the complexity. But we've actually managed to, I think, build a pretty strong, viable palm program. We've done about 50 cases up until this point, mostly for primary achalasia. As Dr. Shada mentioned, there's a couple of redos. We're one of only 2 palm programs in the state currently, and we're working on writing our experience up. So in summary, I use palm as an example here, but obviously it's not just an MIS, but colorectal, surgeon, endocrine. There's constantly new devices and procedures developing. And thinking about whether or not you're actually doing research or you're just trying to take care of patients, I think it is important when you're thinking about IRB review. Hospital credentialing, I think, is an important way to have some quality control on who is taking up the technology and who's performing it. And then one thing to keep in mind, there's going to be a learning curve. I think having an OR team that you've worked with, not only in the OR, but outside the OR is helpful. The issue of insurance coverage, I think, is a topic for an entirely different talk because, you know, if you think about those devices that I had up there, a few of them are approved by insurance, a few are self-pay. POEM, when we started, really wasn't approved by anyone. We managed to convince our UW insurer, Quartz, to cover it after about a year or so, but the coverage outside is sort of mixed. But that's certainly something that you'll need to think about before you adopt new technology.
Thank you, Dr. Funk. To learn about upcoming CME meetings presented by the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health, visit med.wisc.edu.